This is The Faith Debate, a theological roundtable gabfest, a free-for-all forum with faith community leaders wrestling over the truth.
Hoo-ah.
In less than one half hour, learn more about what really matters than what most others learn in a week.
Hoo-ah.
The Faith Debate is on the World Wide Web at WFMD.com, keyword faith. Are you ready for the clash of ideas? Are you ready for the sound of freedom? Let's get ready to rumble in this corner, weighing in with a Master of Divinity from Reformed Theological Seminary, the Faith Debate Master of Ceremonies,
oh, yeah.
Troy Skinner.
Why has there been such an increase in the use of foul language on Facebook? Am I only one who's noticing this? People who used to swear only occasionally are now swearing a lot more, and people who used to never swear at all have now taken up the habit. What gives? That is one of the things that I posted on social media this past year. And there's some other things that got some traction, got some shares, got some comments going back and forth. And I'm going to give you some of the highlights from this past year from the social media feeds right here on The Faith Debate. So no panel discussion this week. So strap in and get ready to hear some fun social media stories. All right, so here's one that I wrote probably somewhere in the middle of the year, I think. Schindler's List caused me to do more than merely cry. It caused me to weep. The Passion of the Christ imprinted indelible images in my mind for months, no, years. Saving Private Ryan left me emotionally exhausted as I sat mute in my theater seat for 10 minutes after the film stopped rolling. I imagine that Unplanned will do the same. You haven't heard of the movie Unplanned? It might be due to an alleged media bias against this movie, a potentially important movie, which sees babies differently, it might be argued, than do the corporate media executives. That is to say, Unplanned sees babies as babies. Media outlets have every right to accept or reject advertisers. However, what they accept and reject speaks volumes. While countless advertisements that objectify women, disparage parents, mock fathers, and encourage consumerist dependence are scheduled to play back to back to back, a thoughtful work of art that addresses one of the most significant issues facing society is said to be problematic. Sad. Very sad. Very sad indeed. Well, I did go on to see that movie, and obviously it was in the theaters out on DVD, and so maybe you now have heard of it. Not a lot of people had heard of it at the time that that social media post went out. And after seeing the movie, I put out a post, and then somebody was kind enough to share my post with these words attached. She said, "I was going to post my comments on seeing this movie with my soon-to-be 14-year-old and my 11-year-old boys, but felt that Troy did it so eloquently. I'm glad I took my boys because after talking to both of them after seeing it, I know it impacted them differently, and I'm so glad to know it did. Each of our children have different personalities, and God has given this to them, and it's a gift that only He can give. Please pray about taking your kids and talk to them about it before taking them to see it." And so here's the post that he shared that prompted him to give me those kind words. I watched Unplanned at a movie theater this weekend. Some takeaways. It's possible to comprehend why it received an R rating, but it'd be just as easy to understand why it could have received a PG-13 rating. When my daughter was in high school, I would have taken her to see the movie. I would have taken her when she was in middle school. Yeah, probably yes. But each preteen is different. The sweet moments in the movie are rather saccharine. At first, this could be off-putting, but considering the heavy weight of the subject matter, the saccharine choices made by the director feel more than appropriate since they bring emotional relief and positivity to an otherwise hard story. There is one scene in the movie, the famous one, that will never be forgotten by anyone who sees it, who sees Unplanned. There is another scene, the final one, that will hit many like an emotional sledgehammer. The profundity of just these two scenes are enough to make this movie forever memorable and forever important. Non-Christians might be tempted to think, no one has a marriage like that, or parents like that, or grace like that. Mature in the faith Christians will recognize these same moments and characters as true to their experience. Pro-life individuals might be tempted to think, no abortion clinic workers could possibly be so upbeat and likable while at the office. Well, given that this movie is based on a true story, it's likely that workers such as these will recognize these same moments and characters as true to their experience. Two styles of Christian witness are portrayed in the movie. The ungracious approach is highlighted for a short scene in an unflattering way, and the gracious approach is what dominates the story and provides an excellent model for Christians to emulate. This instructive element of the movie is one of its most substantive strengths. This movie might be considered to be preaching to the choir, with only pro-life people paying to go and watch it. This would not be all bad, as it will motivate more prayers, more commitment, more love for the babies and for the people working in the abortion industry. This movie might be seen by at least a segment of people in the pro-choice camp. If so, it seems conceivable that some will give thought to reconsidering their view. However, even if their view remains unaltered, at least they will likely better understand why their pro-life neighbors feel as strongly as they do. Better understanding of those with whom one disagrees is nearly always a good thing. So there is value in seeing unplanned, no matter the politics of the moviegoer. So somebody wanted my take on a story and sent me a link, and all they said was, Troy Skinner, comment? So here's what I wrote, and you'll be able to tell what the story is without me having to read a lengthy portion of that for you right now. In some ways, it might be argued that Linda Sarsour is a poster child for how Christians should not behave. But let me start by saying that she is passionate about politics, a very progressive, democratic, socialist Bernie supporter and Israel critic, and advocates for what she sees as needed reforms in civil rights for women, Muslims, and blacks. This is all fine as far as it goes. People who disagree with her, her politics, and her activism can exercise their rights to engage in debate with her. However, she claims to be fueled by rage and expends tremendous energy attacking what she's against to the detriment of advancing what she is for. Christians should not wake up outraged every morning and remain perpetually outraged throughout every day. Christians should avoid ad hominem argumentation and avoid mischaracterizing their opponents, unlike Sarsour, who in the video labels her detractors as fascists, tyrants, white supremacists, and Islamophobes. Christians should seek to be accurate in characterizing government policies, unlike Sarsour, who speaks in the video of a United States Muslim ban, and Christians should work to avoid being misunderstood merely because of tone deafness. I'll have more to say about this in the next paragraph. Let me clear my throat. Sarsour, when addressing assimilation, could have meant that Muslims should not ever forsake what it means to be Muslim when they live in a secular society. Sarsour, when addressing jihad, could have meant merely the spiritual struggle that is foundational to Islam and its aim at submission. However, she almost certainly knows that the words assimilation and jihad are lightning rods and often carry with them much less benign meanings. Why was she not more careful to add context to these words so as to minimize the potential for misunderstanding? Was she purposely vague? Was she meaning to be provocative at the cost of clarity? Does she, in fact, understand these words in a rather sinister way, but wants to leave open the avenue of plausible deniability? We cannot know her heart motivation. We can know that such rhetoric as this will not always be granted the benefit of the doubt. So, as Christians, we must seek to speak with clear wisdom, maintaining an attitude and motive of love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Lashing out at political enemies is often rooted in fear of the world. Christians have been called to a fear of the Lord and out of a fear of the world. People like Linda Sarsour are not boogeymen with an ability to thwart the plan of God. To be clear, and with the aim of transparency, I believe that the policy goals and the public attitude of movements such as Sarsour's are unhelpful, to say the least. Of greater weight, though, is the religious lie that was established 14 centuries ago. There is a compelling argument to be made that Islam is basically a Christian heresy. Whether Christian heresy or merely a false religion, the eternal consequences are profound. Christians should pray for revival so that people believing lies about God might be converted, and so that those knowing the one true God will behave accordingly out of gratitude for what he has done for them. Now, Facebook comments, by their nature and their scope, they don't always allow enough space to fully present detailed responses. This is particularly true when addressing controversial issues. So in follow-up to the previous comment, I provided a couple of links to short articles. They were short, but they were longer than any Facebook comment could be and still be considered of reasonable length. By the way, that's what I'm trying to spit out. If you're curious, as it turns out, both of the stories I linked were found on the Gospel Coalition website, and I would commend it to you. The Gospel Coalition website is a very helpful resource in very many instances. Yeah, I mentioned, I think it was last week, about the death of somebody that I knew and had influence on my life. Here's another post about exactly that sort of thing, following the death of the Reverend Howard Griffith. Quote, when Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, where have you laid him? And they said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. So the Jews said, see how he loved him. That's John chapter 11, verses 33 through 36. Howard Griffith's wife's name was Jackie, and so I wrote, as Jackie weeps, Jesus weeps with her. As others are deeply moved and greatly troubled, so too is Jesus. Oh, how he loves him. Howard was a pastor. He was a seminary professor. He's somebody that I learned an awful lot from myself, and he is greatly missed by very many people. Lightening things up a little bit. Totally different context, not even a religious post or faith-related post on Facebook. I said, for the next 13 seasons, Mr. Harper, Bryce Harper, will be paid more than $17,000 per inning that the Phillies play, nearly $160,000 per game. I should have spent more time learning to hit curveballs. Incidentally, as a Cub fan, I hope that Bryce brings to Philadelphia the same level of success that he brought to the Washington Nationals while he played there. And ironically, of course, right? Bryce Harper leaves the Nationals, and their first season without him, they win the World Series. Anyway, reemphasizing the math, every time a pitch is thrown in a Phillies game over the next 13 years, Bryce Harper will be paid $525 on average. Not every pitch that he faces as a batter, but every pitch thrown in a game by either team, $525. A person earning $15 an hour will be paid $525 after 35 hours of labor. For some, 35 hours is a full week on the job. I have no point to make. I'm simply finding the math fascinating. This is the Faith Debate Special Edition. I'm going through my social media feed from the last year. The things that got the most traction, were shared the most, got the most comments, or just strike me as the most interesting, I'm sharing with you here on the Faith Debate. So I just gave you something light. Here's something very profoundly serious. I wrote, 79% of Planned Parenthood abortion facilities are in black or Hispanic neighborhoods. Why? 3 of 10 Americans are black or Hispanic. 5 of 10 poor Americans are black or Hispanic, and yet 8 of 10 Planned Parenthood abortion clinics are in black or Hispanic neighborhoods. I've been told by some that there are so many abortion clinics in minority neighborhoods due to economic status, not race, but the stats don't bear this out. So what gives? Still feel that way. Feel strongly about that way. The placement of abortion clinics strikes me as overtly racist. Overtly. Now going back in a lighter direction. I had a little picture that I put up on the Facebook post that said, Proud Papa, and then I wrote these words. Years ago, my daughter did things that prepared her for today. Here's what I mean. Years ago, my daughter was strongly advised by a teacher to drop a class. My daughter instead chose to work hard, bet on herself, and trust God. She proved the teacher wrong, ending up with one of the best grades in the entire class. Years ago, my daughter was bullied by a coach working to tear down her confidence. My daughter, instead of quitting, worked hard, bet on herself, and trusted God. After several years of persistence, she went on to make the all-county team, played in the high school all-star game, and received the Defensive Player of the Year award. A few months ago, my daughter rejected a guaranteed permanent full-time job offer from a just-okay company. My daughter instead chose to accept a temp position with a better company in the hope of parlaying that into a permanent job offer. She worked hard, bet on herself, and trusted God. Well, drum roll, please. Today, with the temp position about to end, my daughter was offered and accepted a permanent full-time position with this better company. To be sure, there are other times when she's worked hard, bet on herself, and trusted God, but that God had other plans for her. Yet this hasn't altered her approach because she has come to understand that even when she doesn't get what she thinks will make her happy, it always works out for the best because God knows her better than she even knows herself. A couple of weeks ago on the show, I shared something that I posted on Facebook about the United Methodist traditional marriage controversy. And that's been going on for a while now, and so I've had multiple posts. So here's another one. Many in this country are rooted in conservative theology are tempted to gloat that enthusiasm should be tempered by the fact that it was the overseas voters who won this vote, a vote to maintain a traditional view of marriage between a man and a woman for the United Methodist Church. And so a decisive resistance battle, I predicted, is about to ensue in the American church, the United Methodist Church in America. And boy, was I right on that. Anyway, back to what I wrote. Many in this country who are rooted in liberal theology are tempted to lash out in anger. That instinct should be tempered by the fact that it was brothers and sisters in Christ who voted their biblically informed conscience on this issue, and to go against such a conscience is neither right nor safe. I haven't seen the country-by-country breakdown, but here's a quote from a news story that helps to explain why I wrote what I just wrote. Tuesday's vote reflected the growing clout of Methodists from outside the United States. The tightening of enforcement of church law was backed by a coalition of members from African nations, the Philippines, and European and American evangelicals. While membership has steadily declined in the United States over the past 25 years, it has been growing in Africa. About 30% of the church's members are now from African nations, which typically have conservative Christian views. In many of them, in those countries, homosexuality is a crime. So, and that story is still in the news, and it's going to be an issue that's been dealt with in Christianity in general, and more particularly in the United Methodist Church for quite some time to come, I think. Another story. Okay, so here's the deal. With the launch of several presidential campaigns in recent weeks, the global climate change rhetoric has picked up steam, and this has me wondering what one should believe about this issue and what the facts are for supporting whatever that belief might be. Here's where I stand at the moment. I do indeed believe that climate change is real. However, as for the nature of the seriousness of the threat, I am presently rather agnostic. It seems entirely plausible to me that human activity has the potential for some impact on climate, but I'm not yet persuaded that human activity is the primary cause for significant climate change. Still, I remain open-minded to the possibility. As for human activity being the entire cause, this seems highly unlikely to me, given the dramatic climate shifts of the past that we have no reason to believe were caused by humans. Please feel free to attempt to educate me, whichever side you're on, with this issue. I always appreciate learning, and so I got a whole bunch of things. Nobody changed my mind on it, by the way. You know, I don't think they can. I think I'm a pretty moderate. Of course I'm going to think that, right? I'm trying to be fair to both sides on that question. All right, looking for some positive news? Here you go. 44% of the world population, 44% of the world population lived in absolute poverty in 1981. That's in our lifetime, right? 44%. Anyway, since then, the share of poor people in the world has declined very fast. In fact, faster than ever before in world history. You wouldn't know it from the headlines, but today we're living through one of the most peaceful times in human history and the least poverty-stricken time in human history. There's some good news, and there's all sorts of stuff you can find online about that. If you want to see a link, go to ourworlddata.org, ourworldindata.org, or just Google Our World in Data Extreme Poverty, and you'll find the link to the direct story that shows you these fascinating statistics. Let's see how much time I have here. Ooh, this is a long one. I'm going to have to save this one for another time. Don't have time to do all of that right now, I don't think. So let me do this instead. I recently had a Facebook exchange with some apparent advocates for unfettered capitalism, who call everything else socialist, Marxist, communist. They make no distinction between the three and tend to go on the attack against anyone who seeks to clarify the differences between the ideologies. I am now left with the idea that these sorts of people are purposely argumentative radicals unwilling to engage in civil discourse, even with those who seek to find areas of common agreement. So until proven otherwise, I will view these wacko, quote-unquote, patriots the same way I view the flat earthers. Nuts. Completely nuts. It is nuts, right? I mean, the stuff that, and the flat earther thing. Holy cow, don't get me started. Okay, I'm going to have to maybe think about drawing this show to a close. I have time for one more little quote here before I wrap up today's show. Perhaps the folklore has had it backwards all these years. A quote from Time Magazine says that Time Magazine tested the accuracy of various groundhogs based on their ability to predict the weather of their relative geographic area. Using data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Punxsutawney Phil is only, this is according to stuff that Time Magazine said, so don't yell at me, Punxsutawney Phil is only 3% accurate in predicting his local weather trends. 3%! If the expected result is flipped, then, according to this one metric, the predictions would be 97% accurate if we went in the reverse. So whatever Punxsutawney Phil tells us, if we believe the opposite, according to this article in Time Magazine, it's we'd be correct 97% of the time because he's wrong 97% of the time. Things that make you say, hmm. Thanks for listening. I've got some other things I want to share with you next week that will also be panel free. And so I'm going to go ahead and wrap up this week's show and get ready to do that for you, prepare my stuff for next week. Thanks for listening. If you want to visit us online, please do so. WFMD.com. Keyword Faith gets you to the Faith Debate page. The drop-down menu for the on-air lineup gets you to the Faith Debate page. If you Google WFMD Faith Debate, that probably gets you to the Faith Debate page. You can also link to the Audio Vault. Or on the Faith Debate page, you can also find audio, can listen to previous shows, go back. I think the shows go back multiple years now, so you can just listen to hours and hours of Faith Debate. I know that's your live stream. So anyway, thanks for spending some of your morning with me today. Appreciate it very much. Till next week, 167 and a half hours from right now. God bless.
Past editions of this program are available in the audio vault at WFMD.com.